Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast. Welcome to Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast 10. It's great to have you. What did you think about The World's Last Wonder Chapters 7 and 8? Interesting to hear a hard science space opera with accurate discussions of gravity published over 120 years ago. I should point out that there are not only multiple definitions of science fiction, but also multiple definitions of space opera. Some readers think space opera means it is a character-driven drama with illogical, implausible, unbelievable settings and actions with limited basis in science. Then there's space opera with a lot of science and barely any character development or even characters. This particular kind of space opera I like to refer to more simply as space fiction. However, for category-driven businesses, that doesn't market very well. Then there is space opera that is just a romance in space with, again, no science, and usually it's a female character falling in love with a male alien. The World's Last Wonder fits more into the space fiction category, and now The World's Last Wonder chapters 9 and 10, where the crew are on approach to Mars and encounter some meteoric craziness. Enjoy!
Chapter 9, An Unexpected Parting. As I have just said, the existing tranquil relations between the two crews were too unnatural and precarious to continue, and every moment increased my apprehension of the sudden breaking of a storm. Matters were brought to a crisis by McNichol Dazzler's proposal to tube the main hatchways together and open a passage for the occupants of each car to penetrate into the other. I knew that with the coming face-to-face of River and Fisher, the storm must burst, with consequences that could not be predicted, and I strenuously advised Apollo to decline the proposal, on no matter what pretext. The mechanical danger of the experiment was quite sufficient to justify such a refusal. The risk of a fatal escape of air would be many times greater than that incurred for tubing together the small discharge traps. Nevertheless, my caution on this point went unheeded. Apollo was prepared to court all risks in pursuance of a plan for triumphing over Fisher by the release of Alice Beston. That the annexator engineer's ingenuity should be made the means of our raiding that car in mid-space tickled his sense of humor. He proposed that upon the cars being gangwayed together, River should remain in bed with his face covered, whilst we found means to arrange that at some moment Miss Beston should be with us on board the Pioneer, and all the rest of the annexator's people be in the annexator. As soon as this could be brought about, we should suddenly close our hatch. The annexator party would then be powerless to do anything against us, as it would be in our power at any instant by varying our speed to break or pull away the rubber walls of the passage, when, if they had not closed their own hatch, they would lose their air, and therefore, if we could also succeed in injuring it so that it could not be properly closed, we could hold them and their car as the most helpless of captives. River, with natural impatience, eagerly supported this proposition, and although I greatly feared the scheme would miscarry, I had no alternative to giving way, unless indeed I had determined to obstruct by violence, which I did not feel warranted in doing. The preparations were accordingly commenced. They were necessarily lengthy, and it would be a matter of some days before the actual through connection could be attempted. Meanwhile, the discharge traps had to be from time to time uncoupled for necessary purposes, and at such times the cars, for convenience of signaling, quitted their tandem position and travelled side by side. We had been so travelling uncoupled for some hours, and Apollo was discussing with me some manuscript speculations of Dazzler's as to the precise nature of the radio motor force, when I thought that I had detected a peculiar shock. Looking out, I perceived a great number of glinting lights about us and realized that we had been overtaken by a small swarm of meteoric stones traveling right in our path at a speed slightly greater than our own. Apollo, however, insisted that there was no special danger, as the similarity of speeds was enough to prevent them from striking us with any great force. "It is now quite certain," he continued, resuming the subject which we had been discussing, "that the power consists in the molecular or atomic motion of the radio motor substance, converted into a unidirectional vibration, the erroneously designated repulsive rays in the opposite direction being merely incidental to the production of this unipolarity of molecular travel, and therefore, whilst he was speaking, I had continued to look out from the observation tubes and suddenly discovered, to my alarm, that the lower face of the radio motor had been broken by the impact of a small meteorite. At the same time, I realized that we were now some way behind the annexator, whereas we had just previously been precisely alongside. A cry of horror escaped me, interrupting Apollo's dissertation. "What is it?" he asked. "It is all over," I gasped. "We are falling back to the Earth." "That is impossible," he replied, quite coolly. "Everything was all right a few minutes ago, and if the machine had utterly broken down in the meantime, our velocity would keep us traveling forward." "But," I cried, "we are dropping behind the annexator, and the reason is plain. Our radio motor has been shattered by a meteorite that took us in the rear." "Nonsense!" exclaimed Apollo. "You must see things upside down. I did not trouble to look at your meteorites before, but I see plainly enough now that instead of their overtaking us, it is we who are forging ahead through the swarm at a gain of, I should say, 3 or 4 miles an hour." To my astonishment, I perceived that this was correct. However, it was equally plain that the annexator was nearly out of sight ahead of us, and I forced Apollo to come and look. He was now as much startled and mystified as myself, particularly as the evidence of the fracture was that the Pioneer had really been struck from the rear. For a time it seemed that all the observed facts were most wildly inconsistent with each other, and that everything which seemed to have happened was condemned by everything else that seemed to have happened as a mere illusion. Fred Rivera saw everything as we saw it, and yet in spite of the support thus vouchsafed, neither I nor Apollo dared rely on the evidence of our senses. If there was anything at all to be understood, it seemed to be that our car had encountered two distinct meteor swarms, moving along the same path but at different speeds, and had at the same moment overtaken the one and, with it, been overtaken by the other. A coincidence so extraordinary and unlikely as to be incredible. Then also, the annexator must have been caught up and carried away by the one swarm whilst we remained behind with the other. The law of chance practically forbade the supposition to be entertained, and yet what else could be imagined? The first gleam of light was thrown on the subject when, consulting the instruments, I found that they indicated a sudden increase of our speed. Gradually it dawned upon me that there had been only one meteor swarm, and that when it overtook us, some influence from it stimulated the radio motor to greater activity, so that we at once began to pass ahead. The annexator's greater speed could be accounted for by supposing that if our radio motor, though broken, received an increase of power, hers, if subjected to the same influence and escaping unhurt, would naturally have had its efficiency increased much more. The question was whether those on board would profit by the unexpected accession of velocity to outrace us now that they could, or whether we might yet come upon the runaway car waiting for us in space. It might be that they had not yet realized the situation, for the mere shock of their increased speed would not have been very noticeable. This, as I learned later on, was in fact the case. By an unusual piece of mismanagement, there was nobody awake on board the annexator when the meteor swarm came up, and afterwards, upon missing us, they imagined we had gone ahead. It was not till after some time that the instruments were examined and that the fact of some exceptional disturbance having happened was thus made manifest. At that time, the cars were out of sight of each other, and there was no sign whatever to indicate what had become of us. In ordinary circumstances, the gravity instruments would have registered the parting of company and which car had taken the lead of the other, but the meteors had so complicated the record that nothing could be made from it. The principals, Solomon and Fisher, may have been secretly pleased at losing us, but the other two members of the party were disappointed, For all that they could tell, however, we might just as well be in advance as behind. So they maintained the speed, since it might be the means of rejoining us, and to slacken pace might be only getting farther away from us, with as much probability as the contrary. Dazzler, it seems, signalled from the annexator in all directions, but although the mere matter of distance ought not to have made the signals invisible to us, especially as we knew in what direction to look for them, yet for some reason or other, we failed to observe them. We signalled also, but our signals must have been lost amid the glint of the meteors, which, directly behind us, flashed irregular crescents of sidelight forward into space. It is possible that one or both of the cars may have been slightly out of a true course, which would tend to account for the signals not being noticed, apart from any additional interfering causes. Meanwhile, the crisis which I dreaded, and which appeared to be indefinitely deferred by the unforeseen parting of the cars, had in fact been precipitated on board the annexator, though in different circumstances from those which would have been probable had the cars remained in others' company. Since Alice knew that Fred Riva was on board the Pioneer, her distress and anxiety at our sudden disappearance got the upper hand, and giving away to her grief, she unthinkingly betrayed the secret. It was perhaps just as well, inasmuch as both Dazzler and Drought had been entirely ignorant of her situation, and now that the matter stood revealed, they gave Fisher an uncomfortable quarter of an hour and declared the girl under their protection. Sir Mark Solomon had begun to manifest rather noticeably some undue attentions which were by this means promptly interfered with, and he and Fisher hereafter conspired together to gain the ascendancy, but the vigilance of the two scientists, whom the scoundrels could not afford to get rid of, as they would not have scrupled to do if they could have managed the car by themselves, prevented any scheme from being attempted. Chapter 10. Mars. We did not learn anything more about the annexator until after Mars was reached, and the remainder of the voyage thither was peculiarly uneventful, except once, when the monotony was relieved in a painful and alarming manner. At a certain part of the way, the gravity of Mars began to predominate over the combined attractions of the Earth and the Sun. It will be evident that when this stage was passed, the radio motor was no longer required as a propeller, but had to be applied in an opposite direction to control the car's natural tendency towards the planet, or plainly, to keep us from falling onto Mars with a crash. But this fall would be in the opposite direction of a fall towards where we started from, and in the same direction as our travel, being still an ascent if considered relatively to the Earth. Therefore, in addition to the gravity of Mars, which had to be resisted sufficiently to make a gradual descent, we had also to overcome the fearful velocity of the car in the same direction, and the necessary expedient was to shut off the propelling power a considerable time before this particular stage of the way was reached, so that the back pull exercised by the Earth and the Sun, while yet their power exceeded that of Mars, would act as a brake to wear out our tremendous impetus. When this was done, I discovered that a mistake had been made by leaving it too long, and on the impulse of the moment I attempted to make up for the blunder by turning the force full on in the direction opposed to our travel. Instantly it seemed as if a violent collision had occurred. This was what I should have foreseen. It ought to have appeared to me beforehand that such an action would probably reduce the car to atoms, developing at the same time an enormous heat, enough to instantaneously turn the wreck into glowing vapor. I should, I say, have foreseen it, and according to all that anybody could have foreseen, the result of my thoughtlessness should have been instant destruction for the Pioneer with all on board. How near it came to that, the violence of the shock betokened, and the fierce heat which flashed through the car, scorching our flesh, as the radio motor power, unable to contend against the momentum of our travel, decomposed itself into thermal vibrations. The center pillar glowed red hot, At the same time, fierce electric disturbances stormed within the car. Fiery globes darted everywhere. Miniature lightnings assailed us, racking us through and through with unbearable pains. And outside, enormous shafts of light went playing far into space, dazzling streamers visible from afar like the tails of a comet, which were seen and measured from the annexator and interpreted there as in fact a cometary display. One huge luminous appendage having been, by Edgison Drought's computation, no less than 800 miles long. It was doubtless to the prompt escape of the obstructed force in the form of these terrific and stupendous external manifestations that we owed our survival. By this time we were already much nearer to Mars than to the Earth, and the remaining distance was covered without further incident. On approaching the planet, we were puzzled by the decidedly changed appearance of those markings which have excited so much curiosity on Earth, and it was quite impossible for us to make head or tail of them. We saw, however, that they could not be regarded as altogether artificial in their origin. Upon approaching nearer, we tested the atmosphere, which we found of suitable quality. We had been gradually reducing the density of that carried within the car to accustom ourselves to such a degree of rarefaction as might be found at the planet's solid surface, and now, gradually exchanging it for Martian air pumped in, we accustomed ourselves to whatever difference there might be in chemical composition. Meanwhile, we circled about the planet, scanning the surface for signs of life in order to make up our minds where to descend. This was now the matter of supreme importance, for if you imagine a voyager from Mars coming hither and consider that he might disembark among savages who would treat him as a god, or among other savages who would kill him out of pure terror, or among sportsmen, or among scientists of a certain kind who would not have imagination enough to regard him as a person, but who would be anxious to stow his carcass in a museum, or again, in the midst of an uninhabited desert, and how small his chances would be of meeting with people who would understand and dare to hold intercourse with him, you will realize our difficulty. We determined to seek out a spot looking most like an earthly city, and there to stay aloft at a safe height, signaling until we could get signals in return, which should come from some place that, on our attention being thus directed specially to it, we could judge to have the look of an observatory, and failing of such result in a reasonable time, to try elsewhere. After considerable skimming and hovering, we decided upon a likely locality, and poising the car aloft a little to one side of what we judged to be the settlement, as a more favorable position for gaining notice than directly overhead, we began to flash the signal lamps, waiting with anxious expectation for a reply from the unknown inhabitants of the world we had invaded.
Now, a quick chat with Alon about these two chapters. You know what blows my mind? We're looking at a science fiction story from the 1900s that predicted orbital mechanics and Mars landing procedures with stunning accuracy. Things NASA wouldn't figure out for another 60 years.
The technical sophistication is remarkable. The way they describe that transition point between Earth's and Mars's gravity shows incredible foresight.
And what really gets me is how they handled the meteor shower sequence, the confusion between crews, neither able to fully comprehend what was happening. It perfectly captures that disorienting nature of space travel, doesn't it?
The physics behind that whole scenario was surprisingly well thought out. The way the meteor shower affected their velocity and complicated their tracking abilities. That's some serious understanding of orbital mechanics.
Speaking of which, that moment when they tried to reverse the radio motor? Terrifying. Those electrical disturbances and that 800-mile-long light shaft really drive home the dangers they were facing.
Well, that's what makes this such perfect hard science fiction. The author never lets dramatic license overwhelm technical accuracy.
You know what's fascinating? The way it balances the technical aspects with human elements. We've got this whole subplot with Alice Beston, plus Fisher and Solomon scheming, but it never overshadows the scientific focus.
So how do you think this compares to modern space fiction in terms of scientific accuracy?
Well, in many ways, it's actually more accurate than some modern stories, like that final analogy about landing on Mars, comparing it to an alien landing on Earth, and having to choose between potentially hostile scenarios. That's some serious forethought about first contact protocols.
The communication strategy using light signals might seem primitive now, but given the era's technology, it's quite logical.
And let's talk about those famous Martian canals. This was written when Percival Lowell was still adamantly defending their existence. Yet the author actually subverted those popular theories by having the crew unable to make sense of the surface markings.
That's what really sets this story apart. The willingness to challenge contemporary assumptions about Mars.
The technical details about managing their descent to Mars are fascinating too. The careful calculations about velocity and gravitational forces, the concerns about landing sites, it's all remarkably similar to modern spacecraft operations.
The way they handled the technology really impresses me. The radio motor might be fictional, but its limitations and behaviors remain consistent throughout.
That's exactly what makes good science fiction stand the test of time. When you establish clear rules for your technology and stick to them, it creates a framework that readers can understand and believe in.
Like, how do you think modern space agencies would handle a similar first contact scenario?
Well, they'd probably follow similar protocols. Careful atmospheric testing, gradual acclimatization, strategic landing site selection. The fundamentals haven't changed much because the physics haven't changed.
The methodical approach really sells the realism of the story, doesn't it?
And you know what else stands out? The attention to psychological effects, the isolation, the tension between ships, the diplomatic considerations. It's all so believable.
That's probably why this story still feels relevant today, even after more than a century.
Looking at modern space exploration, so many of these basic principles still apply. The velocity management, communication challenges, landing site selection. It's like reading a modern mission protocol.
The author really was ahead of their time in understanding these fundamental challenges.
And now we're left wondering about their Mars encounter and potential reunion with the Annexator crew. It's remarkable how invested we can become in a story that's so technically focused.
That's the mark of truly great science fiction. When the science enhances the story, rather than detracting from it.
Things are definitely hotting up with this story. I hope you enjoyed The World's Last Wonder chapters 9 and 10. Podcast 11 will feature the first appearance of two intelligent alien civilizations in an Australian space fiction story as Apollo Jones, Fred Reaver, and the narrator land on Mars. Difficulties in communicating are overcome with help from linguistics, and the crew finally meet up with Alice Beston and the scientists McNichol Dazzler and Edgison Drought. A reminder that the Vintage Sci-Fi podcast is non-profit. If you'd like to help contribute to some of the costs, please check out the science fiction short stories anthology book and ebook series entitled Alien Dimensions, edited by Neil A. Hogan. You can find issue number 26 on Amazon. Even reading pages via Kindle Unlimited can help. Thank you.
Vintage Sci-Fi Podcast.